Good morning, Your Holiness, and thank you for all of your time, and we've come to the last day now. Just to very, very briefly sketch the arc that we have traversed during the past several days, we began with an overview of the scope and the severity of the problems associated with craving, desire, and addiction. We talked a little bit about some of the antecedents, the propensities that may predispose an individual to this kind of behavior. With Mark Lewis, we had an introduction to the experience of addiction and what it means for the life of an individual. And then beginning with the second day of the meeting, we began to consider the brain, and we, with Kent Berridge, reviewed some basic neuroscientific evidence about the circuits in the brain that are important for craving and desire, and we specifically distinguished between the circuits that are important for wanting and for liking, and Kent showed that these are represented differently in the brain. And that afternoon, Jhimpala gave us the Buddhist view on craving and grasping, and it gave us the perspective from the mind. On the third day, we then began to journey into the life of real human beings who are addicted, and we had Nora present to us on the clinical neuroscience of addiction. And we consider the role of dopamine and the role of dopamine receptors in addiction. And then in the afternoon that day, we, with Vibeka, delved into the social context of addiction. And then yesterday, we spent the entire day on contemplative approaches, both the Buddhist approach with Metula, and Wendy gave us a beautiful and powerful exposition of a Christian contemplative perspective. And these contemplative perspectives give us some sense of what tools we might actually use from contemplative traditions to target specific constructs in the mind that may also affect the brain that may be helpful in actually working with individuals with these disorders. And that brings us to this morning. And this morning, finally, we've arrived at the point where it makes logical sense for Sarah Bowen to present. Sarah has been at the University of Washington for most of her professional career. And she has been a pioneer with her colleagues in developing mindfulness-based approaches to the treatment of addiction. This is the premier work going on in the world on using simple, secular, contemplative approaches to the study of addiction. And it's being done in a scientific context where hard-nosed evidence is being collected to examine the impact of the secular, simple, contemplative approaches on different aspects of craving and addiction. And so it's with great pleasure that we have Sarah with us today, who will speak on this topic.
Good morning. I'm so grateful to be here
today. I think yours is not on. You need to open it up.
Yes?
Should go on now.
Okay. We good? Yeah, great. Wonderful. Very grateful to be here this week, and it is a tremendous honor to be in dialogue with you this morning. As Richie said, I wanted to share with you some of the work that I've been doing with my colleagues with the intention of integrating contemplative practices with some approaches from Western psychology for the treatment of addiction. So just a brief overview of what I'd like to share with you today. As I said, the overall intention is this integration of evidence-based practices from a Western psychology approach with contemplative practices, and looking specifically at what those practices are and what we're attempting to target, reflecting over the last week what we've been hearing, these processes, and how can we target these with specific practices. And then I'll briefly also review what some of our studies are showing us in terms of how this is working, and if it's working, and some of the mechanisms that might be at play, and also a look at where we might go in the future. So as we've been hearing over the last several days, one of the core features of addiction is the chronic relapsing nature. So it's often actually referred to as the nature of this is that it is relapsing. So while we have practices, we've heard a little bit about the 12-step approaches, the Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous approaches, cognitive behavioral approaches to help people get off of substances.
Cognitive behavior.
And just a note here, I know we've talked a bit about would it help to say more about cognitive behavioral? So the 12-step approach we've discussed, cognitive behavioral using skills, basic cognitive skills and behavioral skills, and also really looking at the content of thought and sort of the whether or not those thoughts are accurate reflections of reality. So we have approaches based on these two practices that indeed help people get off of substances. However, we still see, as Vibeka pointed out with the graphs that she showed, that many decades later we have a very high percentage of people who are relapsing. So 60% of people in treatment in the first year and about half of the people just within the first couple of months. So it's clearly an issue we need to address. And what we know from some of the research over the past several years is that we can identify some of the reasons that people are relapsing. So after a period of abstinence following treatment, there have been studies looking at what is it that causes that first initiation of substance use again. And we see that one of the most popular answers to that question among people with addictions is negative emotion, oftentimes anger, depression, anxiety, that will cause people to begin using again. Also craving, of course, as we've been hearing a lot about. Social pressures, again, we've been talking about the environment and going back into an environment where the individual may have previously used can be precipitant for relapse. And also, there's some evidence on the role of self-efficacy, meaning individuals' belief in how well they could do in a high-risk situation. And people who don't believe that they can do well predicts actually that they tend to not do well.
Self-trust.
Self-trust. Yes, thank you. So we've seen several models of addiction and relapse. I'm going to share with you the model that we've been working with. So there's a propensity oftentimes for people to be more vulnerable. So we're starting off with some vulnerabilities and some factors that may make people more vulnerable to addiction and relapse. And then this individual, say this person has been gone through treatment. We're focusing in this work specifically on people who have been through some kind of treatment, have been able to get off the substances, but then working with them to help them not relapse again. So an individual coming out of treatment, say, faces a trigger of some sort. So maybe it's an emotional state, or maybe they get in a fight with a spouse. And following this, there is some discomfort or dissatisfaction with the way things are. So this individual is not wanting to feel the way that they feel. and looking for some kind of relief or escape. And oftentimes for people with a history of addiction, that escape takes the form of craving for a substance because of that sort of repeated habitual pattern, which, as we know, is often followed then by some use of an alcohol or drug. And then what we see after this is that there is a temporary alleviation. Otherwise, they wouldn't be engaging in this. It is effective in some way for a short period of time, and that kind of strengthens this cycle. However, of course, in the long term, we know that that relapsing into substance use is followed by tremendous amounts of shame, guilt, thoughts of being a failure, lowered self-efficacy, which then perpetuates this cycle again. You know, the person feels more discomfort, more shame, and that keeps this going and can really have this individual caught in this cycle. So this is kind of the model that we've been working with. And oftentimes, people with addictions will describe this as feeling as though it's automatic. They'll say, you know, I don't know how this has happened again. It just seems to kind of happen despite my intentions and my best willpower. As we heard from Mark, you know, these intentions to stay sober, and yet somehow this keeps happening. So in the work we've been doing, we have been thinking a lot about what could be helpful here, what's needed to kind of come in and pull people out of this cycle. And at the core of what we've been doing is trying to train people with addictions to have an awareness of this cycle so that we can kind of step out of that sense of it being automatic and help people to see for themselves what is leading to what, so maybe they'll have some choice there. So part of this also is trying to engender some curiosity about this process. So teaching people to become curious about craving rather than being afraid of it or feeling like they're doomed when they're craving, you know, bringing some curiosity to this, or bringing some curiosity even to the feeling of discomfort rather than having to get away from it, becoming more curious about it and having some flexibility there in how they might respond so they don't have to just automatically respond in the ways they have in the past. And ultimately, of course, this process takes a tremendous amount of compassion for themselves to kind of help alleviate some of the feelings of shame and fear that perpetuate the cycle. So in thinking about how to bring these elements into a program of treatment, we pulled upon many different sources. So we looked to some of the Western cognitive behavioral approaches. My mentor, Alan Marlatt, did a tremendous amount of work in a cognitive behavioral approach to preventing relapse. So some skills, looking at the role of thoughts. So we've pulled quite a bit from that tradition, as well as from Jon Kabat-Zinn and Zindel Siegel's work, who laid some beautiful groundwork for how to integrate these contemplative practices into a Western medical context.
Jon Kabat-Zinn said much mind and life, not only mindfulness, get trauma, stress, and we're watching Shiva, who gets in three. Zindel Siegel said it's a period in Toronto. Toronto. And Toronto, she built up the Jabra, could do so to Manisha, nature that told you a position.
And what they have done, which is so lovely, is really provide a model for how to bring these contemplative practices into a framework that works very well in a Western medical psychological context. Jon Kabat-Zinn originally working with chronic pain, and Zindel Siegel integrating Western treatment for depression with the contemplative practices. So drawing upon those models, we have been working with a program that we're calling mindfulness-based relapse prevention. So based on mindfulness and awareness in the interest of preventing relapse. And as I said, we're using strategies from wherever seem useful and bringing them in and integrating them as best we can primarily from mindfulness, meditation, and cognitive therapy. Working with clients, as I mentioned, who have completed an initial treatment, so the drugs and alcohol are out of their system, and they're at a place where they're ready to move forward with their lives, and we want to help them not relapse. And the form that the courses have been taking... We've been working in outpatient settings, so we meet with clients weekly for 8 weeks for about 2 to 2.5 hours.
And is it individual to individual or group?
These have been group based. Thank you. And one thing that we found that's really lovely about the group based format is the people get to hear from others and realize that it's not their own personal problem. It's a very much a shared experience, and they begin to see that others are going through such similar processes, and this is more about being human than being an addict. So we've kept the group-based format to have that understanding. Each of the sessions we include, we begin with a formal meditation practice right away, and I'll say a little more about what those look like. And then we really emphasize more informal practices, so how to bring these skills and factors that we're fostering in the mind out into day-to-day life, and specifically situations that might be high risk for relapse. And then also bringing in skills, basic, really practical skills from the cognitive behavioral tradition for preventing relapse. Looking at the overall arc of this program, it's really our intention is to have a progressive training in awareness and kindness and curiosity. So we begin, as do the other mindfulness-based programs that we're basing this upon, with a very tangible object.
Give an example. Yeah.
Yes. So we begin with an exercise involving eating a raisin, which is we've borrowed from
the.
So we are asking the clients to bring their awareness to an object that's very tangible and using their senses to explore that.
Why not use the breath?
Well, we move to that.
So it's not just looking at the raisin, though, you're eating it.
Yes. Yeah. So we have them explore.
That because he's only saying that if you're choosing raisin as the object of your focus, you might as well focus on the breath.
Yes. Okay. So our
can you explain the rationale?
Yes.
Explain how it's the whole sequence.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So we begin in the very first group. People come in and sit down. It's their first group.
Because just locking onto a food is something even the birds can do.
Yes. Yes.
Breathing,
the birds will not be able to become aware of their breathing.
Breath, yes.
Breath.
Our hope is that this is a first step towards becoming aware of more slightly subtler experiences such as the breath. So in the raisin exercise, we have clients use their eyes to look at it. We even have them listen to it, use their ears, smell it, and taste it, and explore with all of their senses this little object that they typically would ignore. They typically just pop in their mouth and not even think about. And it's a wonderful way for one thing, I think it helps people who are not familiar with meditation and may have some preconceived ideas or not really be sure they want to do this, they think it's odd. it helps to make it a very simple, tangible, right, kind of fun experience that we're just going to play with a little piece of food and see what that see what that's like to listen to a raisin. So it's kind of a playful way to introduce people to this sense of awareness or these practices. And another thing I appreciate about this exercise is that people realize oftentimes how unaware they are in their daily lives. So we ask them to contrast, how do you typically, is this different from how you typically pay attention to your food? And most people say, yes, I've eaten thousands of raisins and I've never even noticed what they look like or that they have a sound or a smell, or I've never noticed when you bite into it how much flavor there is. So it's also a way for people to realize, to begin to notice their sense to be on autopilot as they move through the day. We move from that tangible external object to more internal objects, such as the breath, body sensation. So we begin to move into, shift into internal processes in the body. And then to more subtle, sometimes sort of less tangible objects of awareness, such as thought and emotion and the nature of thought and the nature of emotion arising and passing.
So it only seems that there is a kind of a big jump, you know, starting from this very tangible object.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden you're focusing awareness on awareness.
Not easy.
That's not easy.
Yes, yeah. Yes, agreed. And we try to, as best we can, kind of gently bring people along over the 8 weeks to go from this to our second practice that we do after the raisin is the body scan meditation.
Yes.
So we have people, okay, can you feel your feet and their toes and pay attention to more of the gross, obvious body sensations. We do that for 2 weeks. Then in the third week, we move into paying attention to the breath. So as best we can, we're trying to train this more fine-tuned faculties of attention. And then as we move through the course as well, we're really heading towards a more self-compassionate and skillful response to any kind of trigger in the environment. And finally, where this is all sort of leading is this awareness of the processes of relapse and freedom from these patterns that are perpetuating the addictive cycle through awareness and compassion.
Can you maybe say how the compassion is cultivated in this?
Yeah, I'm going to say a bit in a couple more slides.
Okay,
is that
great.
Okay? Great. One of the primary focuses of this program is to look at craving and try and dismantle it a little bit. Oftentimes, as Mark was saying, people with addiction will describe craving as their worst enemy because it feels as though once you're craving, bam, you're going to use. You know, it's already over. Once a craving arises, it can be a very exhilarating and exciting and also terrifying omen for what's going to happen. So we're trying to bring a little more curiosity to this and break it down a little so maybe it's not so overwhelming. And so throughout the course, we do a lot of practices in beginning to look at what are the elements of craving, what's actually happening. And if we can begin to learn to observe these elements of thought and sensation and emotion, then maybe, yes, okay, I can be with a thought, I can be with a sensation, I can be with an emotion. That's all that it is here.
Somebody any craving the story. Thought.
So the third aspect of this is thinking about the object.
Yes.
The craving.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, for example, we do in the second session, we have an exercise where we ask the clients to just notice when they're triggered by something. It may be substance use that they're craving. It may just be food. It may be any kind of reactive behavior. And we give them a worksheet asking them to notice what thought came into their mind, like, oh, I have to have this, or and to notice the bodily sensations that go along with this and the emotions that go along with this, so they can start identifying the different pieces of the experience.
And they write it down. Yes.
Yes. In that exercise, we have them actually write down in columns each of these experiences. Thank you. And we also have some practices I'll tell you more about in a moment. Identifying this link between craving and the grasping reactivity aspect of it. So the craving arises, and then the urge to react to that craving, and learning how to identify that and maybe relate to that differently. And also, we have some practices looking at what people are projecting onto the object of desire, and having them observe for themselves that it's actually a false promise. This isn't actually going to deliver what I want. What I want is some relief, or some freedom, or some peace, and that is a very wholesome need and desire. And of course, we want that. The problem is that this doesn't actually deliver that. And can we recognize the needs underlying craving? So essentially, what our intention is here is to, there's this very strong, as we've been hearing from all these different perspectives, link between craving and use that's seemingly automatic, and trying to attenuate that relationship. And instead, when craving arises, can we pause, notice this craving, pause, shift our focus to the experience that's happening rather than the object that we've been fixating on. Shift our experience to the thoughts, sensations, emotions, with a sense of curiosity, so that it's not a scary thing that we have to get away from, but we can actually almost befriend it in a way and be curious about it. And that might allow some space for a more skillful action that will actually serve our needs. So a little bit more about the actual practices that we're doing to kind of target these processes. Told you a little bit about this first practice in the first session of eating this raisin, bringing all of our attention to this and sort of demystifying what meditation and mindfulness can be. And then following that first session, we ask the clients to, as best they can, bring that kind of attention to something that they're doing in their daily life. So we ask them to go home and pay attention to something that they would usually just think was boring or insignificant, like maybe shampooing their hair or putting on their shoe or brushing their teeth. And to see what happens when we actually bring attention to these routine activities. So the intention here is to begin already from the first week to start waking up and paying attention to things we ignore, and also to be in contact with things that are naturally reinforcing that we might miss. So, for example, you know, shampooing our hair, it can be a really wonderful experience, but most of us are off thinking about something else when we're in the shower. We also, as I mentioned in the first few sessions, begin this this practice of the body scan, doing a progressive kind of tour of sensations that are happening in the body. And again, the intention is to begin bringing the attention into our internal experience so we can be more aware of the body. So many people with addictions are very cut off from their physical experience. The body is not their friend. It's something that, you know, is uncomfortable a lot of times. There's a lot of withdrawal. So it's also bringing a friendliness and attention to this thing that we're carrying around. And also practicing the flexibility and shifting of attention. So starting with the attention on the toe and then releasing that and moving up to the ankle or the foot and releasing that. So beginning to train this ability to move our attention at will from place to place. And then moving from that, as Your Holiness pointed out, it's not an easy transition to move from more concrete to the more subtle. So we move then in later sessions to attention to things that might be a little more subtle, such as the breath and thoughts. We spend a whole session on you know, noticing what thoughts are arising and noticing how if we attach to them, they build, and if we let them go and be, they tend to pass. And also emotion, and what, how does that manifest itself? We have a few practices where we pull in some metaphors and visualizations. Most of the practices are simply paying attention to what's happening in the body and mind. A couple practices, such as this, the mountain meditation, we use to help clients get in touch with aspects that they have in their experience, but maybe don't realize that they have that kind of their wisdom and their ability to be, in this case, stable in the face of whatever might be going on around them, to have a sense of groundedness and rootedness and strength and dignity, which oftentimes our clients don't feel. They feel very small, and they feel like they're a victim to their environment. And by bringing in this vision and these qualities of a mountain into their own bodies, begin to get in touch with that sense of groundedness and dignity, which so many of them have lost. And then finally, we do practices throughout the course on kindness and forgiveness. And we've heard a tremendous amount about how much shame there is and lack of self-compassion. So focus on compassion for the self and kindness towards the self. And what we found with the metta practice is interesting, that it's so difficult for many of these folks to... very difficult for a lot of our clients to send themselves kindness. So we actually have them start with sending kindness to someone who's very easy for them to love, and then see what it's like to shift from that to themselves. We've spent a lot of time with that shifting. And forgiveness, we've begun more recently to add in practices of forgiveness, specifically forgiving others for who have hurt them, forgiving themselves for the ways that they have hurt other people, and also forgiving themselves for ways that they've hurt themselves. So I think one of the most interesting practices for me as a therapist in these groups is the discussion that happens after we do these meditations. And this is a process that we call inquiry. And what we are intending to train... Okay. What we're intending to train here is this discernment between what's actually happening, the direct experience, whether it's a sensation or a rising of a thought or an emotion, and what the mind does with that experience, all the reactions and judgments and things that the mind tends to do that get us into trouble. So, for example... We do a meditation in the session, a breath meditation, and we ask people what was their experience like of that, and maybe somebody says, this is too hard. So as the therapist, we recognize, okay, this sounds like a reaction to something. So we ask, well, do you remember what happened right before? That sounds like a thought came up in the mind. Do you remember what happened right before that thought that may have preceded that? And the client might say, oh yeah, my knee was hurting and I felt really restless. And then a thought arose, this is too hard. So what we're trying to do here is help these individuals see this process and discern between what's actually happening and what we add to what's happening that tends to make our lives more difficult. So... the idea here is that the more we do this in the session, that this can begin to then generalize out into daily life, where maybe a client is, briefly here, yes, the discernment between what might be pain, raw pain that is inevitable, in our direct experience as humans, and differentiating that from what actually causes suffering, which is our what we add to it that makes it suffering. And that this process then can generalize into daily life. So training clients to see that, okay, if I'm out in my daily life and a thought arises, I can't do this, I have to grab for a drink, I need a drink, they might recognize that that's a thought and learn to ask themselves, to inquire in themselves, oh, what's actually going on here? Okay, what's actually going on is I feel anxiety, I have some physical discomfort, there are some thoughts arising. So coming back to that raw experience of what's actually happening versus the ideas. And also in doing this in the group setting, there's a really wonderful illustration about how this whole process is not personal. It's how the mind tends to work, and people begin to see that this is just how the mind tends to work. It's the nature of things. It's not their personal problem. Another practice that seems to be the one that clients really hold on to when they leave treatment is one that we call the sober space. Sober meaning not using alcohol or drugs, and it's an acronym. So this is just the acronym is intended for people to be able to remember the steps of this practice. So this is a practice that is designed for times when where the individual might really be in trouble, that moment where they're going to make that decision, they're either going to use or they're not going to use. And up until this time, we've been doing some training and helping clients recognize those triggers. And so now we're moving into, okay, you've learned to recognize these triggers, what these might be in your life, what do you do? So the first step is simply noticing what's happening. Okay, yes, I'm triggered in this situation. And just by that noticing, shifting out of this autopilot where we tend to react habitually and moving into more awareness. And doing that by observing what's going on internally. So shifting the focus, we hear about this, you know, narrowed focus in times like this on the object, and shifting that focus from the object to the internal experience. And then gathering the attention and grounding, getting out of the head more and really grounding by paying attention to sensations of breath for a few moments. And they've been training in this up until now, how to attend to the sensations of the breath. And then after having gathering the attention in that way and perhaps grounding a bit, the expand is expanding the scope of the attention to include the full experience, the situation that they're in, and also expansion of the capacity to be with the experience. So oftentimes, you know, it feels very like it's sort of this impending craving, and expanding the space around that experience. And then finally, choosing a response rather than doing the habitual reaction. So even with the emotions, the sensations, the everything that's going on here, the urges, the recognition that I can still choose a response.
Stop, observe, breathe, breath, expand, response. Sober.
So yes, so those that helps oftentimes people remember this, that acronym. Another practice that we use quite a bit that's one of these informal practices is one that we call urge surfing. And this is a metaphor to help clients when they feel an urge to react arising, and typically they would react, to learn how to stay with it. And we lead them through several practices in the sessions to, we actually have them recall a situation where they feel triggered and uncomfortable, and walk them through how can they stay with that and observe what they're feeling and ride this wave rather than fighting it or getting wiped out by it. How can they stay with it using their breath and their awareness to stay steady? And this is really built on a practice, an idea that's used a lot with phobias or anxiety, where the idea is that if we can come in contact with something that we typically react to in a negative way, come in contact with that experience and be with that experience in a way that is compassionate and safe, it tends to lessen the intensity of that experience. So as we've been hearing, and as Mark illustrated beautifully, that oftentimes the experience of a craving, the subjective experience from an addict's point of view, is that it's going to go up and up and up and up and up until we do something to stop it. You know, I have to make this stop. I can't stand this. I need to grab whatever I can to make this stop. It's so uncomfortable. In reality, what it actually looks like is this. Is it, you know, these experiences increase to a certain point, they get very intense, but then eventually they wane, they don't stay forever. And by helping clients learn this experientially, by walking them through this and having them actually sit through a craving and ride it until it decreases, they not only learn that they can be with this in this way and they have this increased self-efficacy or self-trust, but also what tends to happen is that this intensity of this urge over time, the more we do this, tends to decrease. So those are some of the formal meditation practices and informal practices that we use. We also use a number of worksheets and have people write sort of assignments. And one of the worksheets that we do is we have people identify ahead of time what are the thoughts that tend to arise that get you into trouble. And the idea here is the more that we become familiar with these kinds of thoughts, the less they can trick us. So, you know, if I tend to have the thought, you know, no one will know, I can just have one drink, and I tend to believe that, and that leads to relapse, by identifying that ahead of time, I know, okay, it can't trick me anymore because I've recognized this thought already. And so I can have some distance from it and not buy into it as much. So we have people identify what we call their individual relapse signatures. So how does your particular mind, what does your particular mind tend to do? And the more familiar you can be with that, the less you're going to believe it, basically. And then we have, towards the end of the course, we have clients walk through a worksheet that looks something like this, where they really track the whole course of their pattern of relapse. So they identify what a typical trigger would be, what that typical initial reaction might be, and then the different pathways that they can go. So if they're able to pause and notice these things, then maybe they can choose a better response and have them notice, okay, if they have this reaction to the trigger and they're sort of on this autopilot mode, identifying what tends to happen then. They have these thoughts, I don't care, it doesn't matter. They believe those thoughts, they react. After they react, they feel horrible about themselves. And so again, what we're trying to do here is have people realize, see what their individual patterns are so that they can recognize that as it's happening and they're not in an automatic pilot mode where they have no control. So we've been doing this program in a number of different contexts, we've done a couple studies with a treatment center, this one up here, in Seattle, Washington, where working with some clients who are, many of them are mandated to treatment through the court system. Many of them have a lot of struggles in their life with money and housing, and have very serious addictions. We've also been...
So what about that prison?
Yes, so another places we've been working is here, this picture up here is a youth prison where adolescents who are incarcerated for very serious crimes, murder, rape, I mean very violent crimes, and are often in for quite a while. And then also working in a women's prison, which is the picture down there, working with women, many of whom will be in there for the rest of their lives, many of whom are going to go back out into the world and have been very drug involved, and trying to help them not relapse and cycle back into prison. So many different settings And I just wanted to share with you some of what these folks have been saying about some of their experiences in this program. There was one woman that we worked with in a private practice group who had been struggling with alcohol use in her life and was in a situation where she felt she was going to relapse, and typically she would have relapsed. There was a party going on at work that she was invited to, and she had already sort of decided in her mind that she was going to relapse. And then she paused, and she remembered, wait, I can pause here and observe what's happening. And this is her words here. She said, I paused and watched my breath. The urges and thoughts would keep poking their heads up, but they got quieter and just weren't as big of a deal. I sat until I didn't feel like I had to act on these thoughts and feelings. Finally, I saw the situation clearly. I could make a different choice. And so she described how she, after this, made a choice to just write a very simple note saying, I'm not going to attend this party. And it was, in her words, just much having that pause. It was just a very simple shift for her. This is another client that we had who had been really struggling with self-hatred and shame, and who said, after engaging in these practices, I have more patience with myself, compassion, ways to get me back into what is happening and out of my head. And then finally, a middle-aged man that we were working with who had been struggling with crack cocaine use and relapsing chronically and really struggled with overwhelming urges and said this, I'm now able to regularly surf these kinds of triggering situations, not just with drinking or drug use, but with other discomfort or unpleasant states. So that's sort of the subjective view of some of the folks we've been working with. I want to tell you a little bit about the studies we've been doing, and this is going to be just a very broad overview. We don't have time to go into all the specific studies, but just a general overview of some of the things that we've been finding with this program particularly. We've done three studies now. One was in a facility with just women, working with just women, and then two were in a public treatment agency. All of these folks had very severe alcohol or drug addiction. Most of them had some kind of co-occurring issue, whether it was depression or trauma or a physical chronic pain condition. So lots of complex struggles. And most of them had fairly low levels of education, maybe high school, and pretty unstable housing, either living in their cars, in group homes, or several of them actually homeless. So a lot to work with, a lot to deal with in their lives on top of their addiction. And we were quite curious about whether we could work with a population this severe with these kinds of practices. Would they practice? How could we get them to practice? Would they show up? Would they be interested? Would they be able to find a place to sit and meditate? A lot of challenges here. And what we found, again, generally across these three studies, is that there were reductions in craving. So over time, their craving lessened in comparison to our other groups that we were comparing them to. And we found that there was indeed less drug use, less alcohol relapse, again, comparing them to the standard treatment that's out there now, and in two of the studies to an evidence-based relapse prevention program, that they seem to be better able to maintain their treatment goals.
The standard treatment here would be the 12 steps or the cognitive behavior.
Yes, yeah. Yes, thank you. So
No medication.
No medication. Okay. Some of the folks were medicated, but we controlled for that in the studies. So. And we also found some evidence that people after this, again, compared to the folks who hadn't taken the course, had a more adaptive physiological response when they were introduced in a lab to a stressor. One of the most interesting findings to me in looking across this is in one study we looked at, we were very interested in this relationship between depression and substance use. Because as I mentioned before, that's the number one reason people say that they relapse is negative affective states, difficult emotion. And so we found in this sample, as with many samples, this very strong relationship between depressed mood and substance use. And that was explained by craving. So people are feeling depressed, they instantly crave something to make themselves feel better, and then they use. And what we found is that for folks who took this course, that this relationship between depressed mood and craving was no longer significant after they took the course. So they were still having some feelings of depression, but it wasn't automatically significantly tied to craving. So that had kind of attenuated. And that then was explaining, statistically explaining how those the reduction in substance use, that was explaining some of the reduction. So what was most interesting to us about this is that in this course, we're really trying to target not so much what's arising, but how we are reacting to what's arising. So negative mood will arise, craving will arise, and it we may not be able to control that, but how we react to it is something that we can have some agency over. So that was our studies. And looking across some other studies of colleagues in the field, we see about 24 studies now looking at mindfulness-based and contemplative practices for substance abuse, 14 of which are randomized trials where people are, you know, we can compare this treatment with other treatments. And again, just a very general, broad overview of what we're seeing is that there seems to be reductions in substance use when they're compared with other treatments or a wait list control where they're waiting to engage in this treatment. And when we look at some of the mechanisms that might explain why these effects are happening, we see this kind of trend that it's not necessarily, again, what's arising, but how we're relating to it. So they're really changing their relationship to both the substance use and to their own internal experiences. For example, we see this certainly a reduction of craving and urges, but also we see some evidence of reductions in reactivity to triggers and urges. So for example, there's one study of smoking where the urges were still arising. They hadn't changed significantly, but the reaction to those urges, the use following those urges, had lessened. So people were learning to relate differently to their own urges. And we also see a reduction in some indices of avoidance, whether it's trying to emotionally avoid things or try to suppress thoughts. That seems to explain some of the changes in substance use. And increases in general measures of mindfulness and awareness, of compassion, and of a sense of having a choice in the matter. So whether I actually have control over my actions or whether I'm a victim to the environment. However, this is still, as I'm sure you're aware of, a fairly young field of research looking at how we can apply these practices to substance use. So while this is exciting, the studies are still relatively small. We have a couple larger studies, a lot of limitations in the methodology, some measurement challenges. How do we measure awareness and mindfulness? So still quite a ways to go, but an exciting journey. I think specifically some of the challenges and things I'm looking forward to exploring are how do we train clinicians to do this kind of work? Who are we? Can we train to do this, and how do we train them? How do we implement such programs? Also, we see that these programs are this program and similar programs are helpful for a number of people. But others are not responding as well. So how can we identify who those folks are and why? Further look into some of the mechanisms that explain these changes, maybe starting to look more at neuromechanisms, and also adaptations. We're really working to be sensitive to different cultures and settings and how we can continue to adapt this program to suit different minds and contexts. And also, as has come up in the discussion over the last few days, motivation and how can we help get people who may be ambivalent about being in treatment, may not want to be there, may be unsure about meditation, how can we help get them on board and engage them? And finally, I just want to take a moment to express my gratitude to my colleagues, mentors, teachers, and all the support that, and this is just a handful of many people who have supported this work, but I wanted to take a moment to thank them. Well, thank you.
Thank you. And Sarah's mentor, Alan Marlatt, sadly died a number of years ago. What year did he die?
2011. He was really one of the pioneers in this field of bringing in meditation practices to treatment of addiction. Yes.
Well, Sarah, thank you for that wonderful overview. And I'd like to begin the discussion just with asking one or two clarifying questions that I think would help all of us and be, I think, interesting to His Holiness. And the first one is about follow-up. In the studies that you talked about, you didn't describe in detail how long those studies continued for, and follow-up not just in terms of substance use, but also the extent to which the involvement in the treatment provided individuals with skills that or practices that they continue to actually utilize in their daily life. So I wonder if what you can share with us about that.
So in the most recent study that we did, we were able to follow people up for a full year and ask them, you know, at all these different time points, what their experiences were. And in terms of the practices, the meditation practices, we asked very specifically what people were practicing, the, you know, each of the practices, what are they doing for how long, how often. And we found in one of our studies that at the end of the 8-week course, so during the course, we asked, you know, did you actually practice this stuff? We send them home with lots of materials to help them practice, with recordings of guided meditations and printed materials. And it's 84% said that they indeed engaged outside of session in the formal practices. And then when we asked...
What, 84%? How frequently? Daily or...?
That it was... an average of, I believe, 4.7 days a week for about 20 minutes a day of those who were practicing. So we were actually very heartened at those results that people were engaging in these formal practices. And when we asked 2 and 4 months later also, were they continuing to practice, over half were still engaging in some sort of these practices.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, that's helpful. Maybe I can just begin this discussion by asking His Holiness the following question. The kind of program that Sarah described is a program that I think is quite typical of mindfulness-based treatments that are now being implemented in the West. We have Sarah described this program for relapse prevention, specifically for addiction, but there's also mindfulness-based cognitive therapy that's mostly being used to treat depression. There's mindfulness-based approaches to eating disorders, and they have the same general framework. And I wonder if Your Holiness can comment after listening to this, if you think that there are specific elements that are missing, that maybe should be included, that are not being included, or if there are modifications that you might recommend. This is very much based upon, as Sarah credited, the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn and others that came before. But these are still very early efforts in the West to secularize these kinds of practices. And given the vast tradition from which you come, this represents an extremely small sector. And so I wonder if you can just offer your reflections on that. Mm-hmm.
Difficult. I appreciate you, I think, very sort of detailed study. So I think you know best.
Mm.
But these things, you see, carry this work and then gain some experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the basis of experience, perhaps...
You modify.
Then you may add some new things.
Yeah.
So I don't know, difficult to say. But these thangel dusna is going blunt to toa. Then I say, you see,
what I have to say may sound like quite blunt.
Oh. These are something like painkiller. Not tackle the basic thing. That as I already mentioned, you see, we must pay more attention about the preventive measure.
Yeah, yeah.
When is a person normal, then you see, educate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the best way to prevent. And someone who already is facing these problems,
mm-hmm.
then these methods are very good, but something like painkiller, temporary.
Yeah.
Hmm. That's my view. So these things, either you know better.
Hmm.
I think not only me. I think at least in India, I think over 10,000 sort of Kasoda students and also scholars. Kitchen Pajishadha.
His Holiness was saying that if that same question is asked not just to him but to the monastic scholars who are in India, about 10,000 of them, we won't have much to say on the actual specifics of the treatment.
But there is possibility, preventive measure. I think one example. This is some monk, or some even some ordinary people. This is spent years in Chinese gulag. A lot of fear, and even it's a fear of death. Very, very alive. But under that circumstances, you see, they can maintain peace of mind. As a result, after their release, their mind, no sign of trauma.
The trauma or mm-hmm. resentment.
So this shows. And then you see some, even my own later, you see, after he reached India, I also received some oral transmission from him, Kermich Kungungunju. Once he told me, while he was in Chinese Gulag, he really sort of dedicate those work, hard labor, fully. And then also, you see, he mentioned to me during those prison life.
Period, no?
No, period. The best period for practice.
Spiritual practice.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So people such have sort of mental attitude, then you see there's no sort of danger of kasada under the samrukang and chaita.
Of depression and all of these things that lead to the addictive mm-hmm. behavior.
And my business, the doctor, for many years, since I think 1950, perhaps I think 50. 52, 53. Tenzin Shira, some of you may know Tenzin Shira. He told me, this is a little sort of funny, right?
Yeah, funny.
You see, he, the one sort of, one time and Cultural Revolution, you see, they have to learn some Chimney Mao Zedong sort of quotation.
From the Red Book.
So at that time, you see, he carried one Red Book, the Chimney Mao sort of quotation, then each word could
teach. So he would kind of assign each syllable like a kind of a beat on a rosary.
Oh, so recite his own prayer. So to the Chinese God, you see, he's really seriously reading
the Red Book.
Chimney Mao's Red Book, but actually he used different way. So he spent, I think, over 20 years, around 20 years. At one time, difficult.
In the Chinese school.
Yes, very difficult in Gansu, I think in Gansu province. When they brought there, I think about 300. Then, I think after two, three years, when they released, only 30, around 30, rest of them. So very, very difficult, but he can maintain peace of mind. After in early 80, you see, found the opportunity to come here.
Come to India.
His mind, very, very relaxed. Then, of course, another sort of monk, not very scholar, but good monk. You see, actually, he told me while he was in Gulag prison. You see, then 18 years, he told me, during 18 years, few occasions, he really faced some danger. And I asked, what kind of danger? His answer is danger of losing compassion towards those
perpetrators, the Chinese authorities.
So he considered it is extremely important to keep compassion towards these troublemakers. So result, his mind, no matter what difficult, maintain peaceful. Now still he's here. Now his age, considered the Chosan Kinsu. About 93. So his mind, very peaceful. So these shows, there is possibility if we train, if awareness now, mainly awareness now, the awareness, long-term sort of interest and short-term interest, then I think we have the human brain have the capacity, not like animal, not like mouse. We have this marvelous brain. If we properly use, I think we have the tremendous ability to face these difficulties, particularly mental sort of difficulties. So that, I think, in the context, is a secular way, I think we can take. So therefore, you see, we always discuss or mention about the education, some more holistic education, that give them some material how to face these problems. The ones is they develop conviction, then they practice that. As a result, best preventive measure. Then you become jobless.
That's my goal, yes.
Yeah.
So that's my view. Otherwise, it's wonderful. These really, I think, the specialist in particular field, really, really expert. Wonderful. And all these carry with sense of concern of others' well-being. So marvelous. Thank you.
Well, maybe now would be a good point to take our tea break, and then we can resume after and continue the discussion.
Good.
Thank you. I'd like to begin this period of discussion with a theme that we have circled back and forth to and from over the course of the week. One of the things that makes this topic so important and so interesting is that we all believe that this is a topic that's more general than just drugs. We are addicted to many different things in our society, to the internet, there are gamblers, and as Nora, I believe, herself raises a possibility in her presentation, we're addicted to money. And so I wonder if we can just ask, maybe first ask Sarah and then Your Holiness, about the extent to which any of these methods may be helpful to individuals who are addicted not just to substances, but to destructive types of behavior may actually have more pernicious effects for our society, more problematic effects than just the substance abuse itself.
We have indeed been working with a broader range of addictive behaviors. In terms of the studies we've been doing, we're in the midst of, with my colleague Katie Wickowitz, who's here with us also, working on an intervention for problem gambling, based very much on this same program. Like, the processes are just so similar, with the craving and the feelings after, you know, relapsing, of shame and guilt. And also what's been interesting is in the private practice groups where we're outside the research context, so it's much looser who comes to the groups. And we have a really varied group of people, folks working with anger and aggression issues, impulsivity, issues around food, issues around violence, even folks with panic and anxiety. And we talk with each person individually before the group, and if it seems that this kind of program would be helpful, we invite them in. And what's lovely is that in those groups, people see very quickly that the manifestation that is their specific issue, whether it's food or drug addiction or gambling or aggression, that it really seems to function very similarly. They seem to notice right away that they have much more in common than they do different from one another. We've also been working in the juvenile prison system. We just started a study there, working with youth who have had a great deal of adversity in their early lives and have made some understandable yet unfortunate decisions and are locked up. And working with them on, a lot of them have tremendous anger, and again, understandably, but that needs to be dealt with. So they have very aggressive behaviors. Working with them on being with those urges, those same kinds of urges, but it's for them, it's to act out violently rather than to use substances. So a wide range of folks that these processes seem to to touch and apply to.
그래 그 저도 그러고 물 gambling 니즈 가가다. 지당물 가보셨어요. 뭐? 그리고 다 세바서 지금 야구스캠도 다 Tan dabal cibi na dabal ya ta ji ta kanda ji dabal ji dabal kore ga nibar jisi lupto ya pes kawre kanda kogo harta ta dabal duyu di o yangda bu ji ta pando yudu jima yina dabal kogo haro o ta dabal yu di pul nubar jima yina ta jindabal di nonjuru awareness.
It's not on.
Solens is saying that, as before, he really feels, you know, in the end, what is the most important factor is really awareness. So we have been talking a lot about craving, but craving is actually, underlying craving is a desire. But desire in itself is neither positive nor negative. Mm-hmm. There can be positive, constructive desire.
And so long, any sentient being who aren't happy, who do not want suffering, desire always there. That's so, part of our mind, mm-hmm. part of our life. Mm-hmm. I think if we really want to eliminate desire, then we should be like plant, no feeling, vegetable, right? Yes. But then very good, become very holy, no feeling.
So what makes desire kind of, you know, dysfunctional? And, you know, if the desire is something that we need and it can be constructive, so what makes it destructive and dysfunctional versus constructive, then of course it has to do with what you are desiring. So the object of the desire, what you're desiring for, really needs to be taken into account. So if it is something that is beneficial and has a long-term, you know, beneficial effects, then that desire is constructive. But the object of desire, if that is destructive, has a long-term, you know, negative consequences, then that desire is directed towards something that is dysfunctional. So I think, again, it comes down to the role of awareness.
Uh-huh. I think ultimate sort of responsibility is awareness. It's the things which temporarily give some satisfaction, relieve something, but long run, harmful. Mm-hmm. Then, with that awareness, restrain. Even you use, because under certain circumstances, compared to use that, yes, they're limited. Limitation, right?
Limit long. So, for example, if you have a greater awareness, then when you engage, you pursue the object of your desire, then you know what you have is you also need to have this ability to exercise this choice. So then you will use whatever it is for whatever you know specific needs that you have. And then once the limit is reached, you restrain, you stop. Mm-hmm. So it's the awareness and the ability to exercise that choice, the freedom, that you know that wouldn't lead to a form of addictive behavior.
There's some negative emotion, and as an antidote, just is thoughtlessness. Not much sort of help. Not much help. Just temporary.
It's temporary.
Long run awareness. Mm-hmm. So investigation. It's extremely important. Mm-hmm. The education. Education means use our brain, thorough investigation, try to know the reality. If we stop that, then, you see, I think long run harmful. Mm-hmm. So we must utilize our brain fully. So investigation with skepticism is extremely important. Then try to look from
different
angles, not just one angle, three dimension, four dimension, six dimension. Then you get the better knowledge about the reality. Once we know the reality fully, then all our approach become realistic. Mm-hmm. So all these want happiness, but wrong method, because lack of knowledge. Persuasion has become unrealistic.
Unrealistic.
Because lack of knowledge about the long-term implications. So everything, education. Then meantime, these, as far as the physical sort of the problem is concerned, of course, modern sort of medical education, these are sufficient. But the mental problem, then we need education about system, where?
System
or map of the mind or emotion. Mm. That we are lacking. Mm. Mm-hmm. So people who never sort of knowledge about, who never sort of pay attention about this inner world, and when is something is happen, don't
remember. So they get stuck. You know, if you don't have any insight into the way your mind works, then when you are confronted with a challenge, you just get stuck.
Yeah.
So all this lack of knowledge. That's why, I think these specialists, you see, you are taking, you see, care. But different field, wonderful. Carry continuously. In the meantime, we must think as the basic level, right? Mm-hmm. Basic level or long term, humanity level. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you see,
So, because otherwise, if our approach becomes very narrow and very specific to a specific set of problems, and then
and only on sensorial experiences, then we don't need any education.
And then lose
No need language. No need letter. Just, you see, like animal, go like that. I think then less trouble.
Brain is too complex, more trouble.
That's right. So it's a source of trouble. But at the same time, you see, that also, you see, can be a source of, because of the immense benefit.
The solution now.
So, not only taking care of oneself, but also the care of the whole planet. No animal can do that. Only we human being. Mm. So I think human brain... I think you know about human, because of the human brain. You also, I think you really, I think, dealing with, I think, real pressures of human body, that human brain. So again, my expression may be a little bit blunt. You see, you just a small part of the brain. I say, you become expert. You should not say, you should not feel, I know everything about the whole brain. No. Still, I think this is the beginning of the 21st century. Next one decade, further.
Progress.
Next decade, further. I think in order to become real expert about brain, I think you should need more knowledge about different emotions. Mm. And their system, their rule, right? Nature of this emotion, and its rule, and its causes, its and role. Conditions.
Its role and functions.
Then, fuller knowledge about emotion, about mind. With that, carry further research.
In brain.
I don't know. Okay.
Our knowledge of the brain is minuscule. We realize that. And one of the things that is so important in this dialogue was the recognition that we are simplifying the processes to the extreme, and we need to expand it. Mm-hmm. So that then we can inquire into a greater depth to the way that we are doing it. We are aware of it. And I do appreciate absolutely the need to look at these processes, at least with six dimensions, with different perspectives, in order to try to approach reality.
Right.
Diana, you have been...
Your Holiness, I am an educator to the core of my being, and I am completely on board and moved and inspired by your messages about education. I am with you. And I wonder, with tremendous respect, whether we might think about these kinds of interventions not so much as a painkiller, but more as a doorway.
Right.
A doorway into another way of providing this education of which you speak so eloquently. Arthur and I have a friend named Parker Palmer who studies social movements. How do people start a process of profound change? He says that the first step is someone needs to suddenly realize that it's too painful to live a divided life anymore. He calls it the Rosa Parks moment, Rosa Parks who sat on the bus. She started the civil rights movement that had such a profound effect in our country. She could no longer live the life, the divided life, of being told she had to sit in the back of the bus because of the color of her skin. That started a huge social movement. I think some of the people who find their way to Sarah have come to that moment when they can live divided no more. She gives them that first taste, starting with the raisin, of a different way to live, of a different way to understand themselves in relation to the world, in relation to their bodies. She gives them the distilled essence of all the wisdom from your tradition. It's only a tiny step forward. It's only a beginning, but it's a door that opens for them. And I think what we can hope is that this work, all the people who are carrying this work forward, will be opening those little doors for people who will then see that there's more to life, and then they can go on and follow in a process of education. And it's another way. At the same time, we want to catch those little children and teach them to meditate. But there are so many people in the West who are in such deep pain that this is another way we can find them and start them down this other path. So I think there's something quite revolutionary happening here.
My impression, you see, I think so many occasion discussion with scientists in different fields. So the some of the those kasure, chosun ne, that chik deya those that, I just measure chete garo.
Ah,
that here ya to inusan ne zawa de that sim tu mo de kanda ro de do.
So it's also saying that in his conversations with scientists, often we have the same kind of topic, but we're approaching it from so many different perspectives and angles, and all of them are really pointing towards a kind of a convergence, which is that much of our problem really are rooted in some way of relating to the world in a different way. It's really mental, ultimately. The root lies in the mental. And
so, directly about mind, I think some people may not pay attention. All these, you see, a little thing here. Of course, you see that because of the sort of immediate effect. So, these maybe you see the symptom of something wrong in the mental level. So the people you see these are effect immediately. So people because of, immediately you see because of
pay attention.
Then further go. Then the awareness. And sort of the key sort of the
factor,
the source of problem is our mental level. So wonderful. So as a result of our sort of meeting with scientists in different fields, so I developed some more because of
conviction.
And the training of mind is something very, very long run, very, very essential. But then training of mind, if we sort of relying on religious sort of concept, then never be universal. So without touching religion, secular ethics, that idea is come. So and discuss with some Indian. So India is not new over 3,000 years. It's in this tradition there. Secular ethics. So I thought the ancient Indian tradition, I think, very much relevant to today's world. So I usually describe myself as a messenger of ancient Indian thought. So sometimes I teasing, you see, Indian gurus or Indians of Varsity, spiritual leaders. I, as a messenger sort of, messenger level, I'm quite active. So now time come, my boss must take active role instead of just pray in their sort of temple and some rituals. It's good, but must come out, deal with the problem, deal with people. Like that. And anyway, I think this is not my own sort of responsibility. Everybody. If there is someone who really want suffering, then exception. But no one that. Isn't it? No one that. Even insect do not want suffering. So it is really worthwhile, you see, explore how to reduce the suffering. Every level, right? No. Every direction, every level. So it is all, so that I'm responsible for everybody, all on, particularly here. So we are not just expanding knowledge, but how to now make a contribution. Better, happier human being, happier family. And through that way, eventually our target is happier humanity. That means then happier world. We may not see that. Perhaps some young people may see that. My generation, I describe the generation of 20th century. Now we belong to 20th century. I think you may be the 21st century. Those people age, you see, below 30, right? 30, 20, then these people are truly, you see, generation of the 21st century. They're people, I think 50, 60, 70, we belong to the 20th century. So now, whether we like it or not, you see, we are ready to say goodbye. Bye-bye to the world. So our responsibility, according to our own experience, tell 21st century people, now our existing sort of lifestyle, existing way of thinking, is not sort of kasoda, not sufficient. We must sort of da kasoda. Yes, things sort of
we must. We must expand. We must really kind of deepen it.
Deepen
in our thoughts. Yeah.
I always feel mainly education. Education makes new shape of our mind and also give the instrument for this marvelous brain. So education is the key factor. Not meditation or Zen meditation. Something like, I think, painkiller
for the short while.
It's very good. Completely relax. But then, after that, you cannot remain that way 24 hours. You have to eat. You have to sort of talk with people. You have to deal with people. So, and then again, problem there. If we use our awareness through investigation, not through single-pointed mind, investigation, then you can better equipped to deal with these problems. Then I think you really feel a sort of relaxation. You really, you see, tackle this problem, not avoid the problem, but face the problem and tackle the problem. Then you get deep satisfaction. Even you sleep, you may dream some. Get some kind of sort of. I mean, because of the daily life, satisfactory sort of life. Satisfactory, not just, you see, drugs or But something, you see, there is more serious challenge. And face that wisely, with full of conviction, with full of willpower. Willpower is what?
Very long.
Then you get real sort of satisfaction. Easy life, satisfaction is very superficial. Difficult life, face. But then you get real satisfaction. Isn't it? Do you agree?
I agree.
Specialist?
Yes.
Okay. Too much. No.
We're here to benefit from your wisdom, Your Holiness, so we really appreciate it. But Metula has wanted to make a comment.
I think the example of surfing is quite appropriate because we know when people surf on the wave, it needs a lot of training. It may look easy, but it's really a lot of skills that you need to acquire. And then also there's always the danger to fall in the wave, and then it's like being in a huge washing machine, no control at all. It's just like that. Hmm? But once you have surfed long enough, then the wave goes down and you are sort of at ease. But so it needs to maintain. So you could compare the surfer to awareness. So if you can maintain, yesterday what I mentioned modestly, that you have the space of awareness watching the craving long enough so that the craving has time to wane and become less strong if you wait long enough. So, or it's like a fire. If you stop adding wood and wait, definitely the fire will go down, but you have to wait enough. So to gain the capacity to maintain the awareness long enough that you don't fall in the craving, then it will subside. So there's twofold advantages, because first, on that episode, that craving, you didn't either just fall into it or you didn't try to suppress it, which did not work. You dealt intelligently, so you succeeded with that episode, that one episode. Then you would do the same with two and three. The accumulation of that will do that next time, as you mentioned, the tendency of or the strength of the future arising of craving will be less and less because you erode the tendency. So at some point, you don't have any more that strong craving, so the whole issue is resolved by dealing moment for moment and with the duration of the training. So I think it's a one of, you know, we like always images. It's quite a beautiful one because it shows like, you know, how awareness could maintain on the craving long enough that it sort of subsides, and then you're momentarily safe, and accumulating that, then the tendency will slowly go away.
Roshi, and then Arthur.
So, Sarah, one of the questions that's come up for me has to do with the training of the therapist, which also applies to the training of teachers. And it's one thing to have a meditation technician, for example, doing this intervention or teaching in a school. It's another thing to have a wise teacher or a wise therapist. So, I'm wondering what you're doing in your program to train therapists to have that wisdom aspect cultivated.
Mm-hmm. This has been a question very close to my heart, and even as you ask it, I feel like just the humility around this issue. our aim, what we want, is to have people coming to this work and working with this program to have to be living their own life that way and teaching from that kind of experience and that kind of wisdom. And the technical, you know, in our trainings, we really kind of, that needs to be there, but the emphasis is on understanding from the experience. What is it like to be with an urge? What is it like to ride that out? So it isn't an intellectual understanding of this. In terms of how we're going about that, we've kind of been flopping around and trying to find this balance between being able to disseminate and train therapists, clinicians who are interested in doing this work, and also really hold to the integrity and the respect of these practices. And it's an ongoing question. So we ask that people who come to our trainings have a deep, well-established practice of their own, including some time in silent retreat, and their own well-established daily practice. And in the trainings, we ask people to put their papers and pens aside, at least for the first few days, and live this and go through it themselves. And then we have a period in the middle where they're just in practice themselves, and coming from that period of practice, move into beginning to implement and teach some of these to try and really keep that line of practice throughout. That said, we don't have much control over, you know, we have a published manual out there. We have, it belongs to everyone. And so that's been a really interesting and rich question that I say returns me again and again to just feeling very humble and open to people's advice and answers around that issue.
Well, so I guess if I could just have a follow-up question to that is, have you looked in your research at therapist effect? Mm-hmm. You know, I would say the same in terms of your work, Richie, in the school system, teacher effect.
We haven't been able to directly because we've tried to match people with less. We have two people leading the groups, and we try and really match. So there's always someone in there with deep experience. What I can say is we did two studies, and the first study was a smaller grant mechanism, and we didn't have money to pay our therapists. They were all volunteers, so they were very gifted, very smart, caring, wonderful people. Not many of them had a very well-established practice. In that study, we found some effects, but they waned over time a bit. In our second study, when we had more means to really pick and choose therapists, our number one criteria was practice, that they have an established practice. And the results in that second study are very different, where we actually see the treatment gains maintained significantly better over a 12-month period than the other groups. So we can't directly compare those, you know, but one of my thoughts is that may be an effect of the therapists who are part of that. I think that would be that study needs to happen. The question is hanging, so right.
I think
this is the program.
This issue is a really important issue, particularly with regard to education. And I'll call on Arthur in just 1 second to comment on this. But we continuously run up against this issue, Your Holiness, in this kind of work, because if we are wishing to disseminate programs in of the sort that Sarah was describing, or in secular ethics, it's very important. All of us believe, I think, that the individuals who are teaching it embody those qualities in an important way, that they live their lives in a way that's consistent with what they're teaching, or else it will not be authentic. And that presents a bottleneck, a constraint in terms of being able to disseminate this as widely as we would like, and I don't think anyone has a magic solution to this. It is why when we've, Your Holiness knows that we're doing some work with games that we developed for children to teach them simple practices of awareness and of kindness, and it's implemented on technology. So that we can potentially disseminate it widely. This was a project that's funded by the Gates Foundation. And the Gates Foundation made it very clear to us that they were not interested in anything that we were doing that is not technologically based. It has to be technologically based, they said, because that's the only way they believe it can really be disseminated globally. And so this is a dilemma that we're all confronting, particularly as we take on, as Mind and Life takes on the Secular Ethics Initiative. And I don't think any of us have any answers at this point, but these are important questions that are being raised. So, Arthur, maybe...
Krang
Yes, the teaching or education about warm heartedness. I think not the also word also is important, but main thing is your real sort of feeling. Yeah, when you sort of tell
communicate,
word, you just communicate,
no.
Which sort of genuine feeling
needs then, to be embodied. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That I think only that way the student gets sort of conviction. Oh, that tenshu tenshu masala.
So in the Buddhist text there is an idea of this, that not only should one be teaching something that is counseling, something that is beneficial, but actually the person who is giving the counsel should live it by example.
Absolutely.
So as to how these could be, you know, problems could be resolved through technological means, you guys would be more expert on this.
Well, even if there were someone who is embodying that, who is showing a video of them, your teachings, Your Holiness, are all over the internet. And that's a way for many people to benefit from your wisdom who don't have an opportunity to meet with you individually. So I think even in those simple ways, we can harness the power of technology for good purpose. So maybe, Arthur, you can please
be glad to
chime in.
Actually, I have something on the previous point that I wanted to lift up, but maybe first a comment with regards to this teaching who we are as much as teaching a content. I mean, you stand up in front of a classroom and the very first thing people notice is the quality of the presence that you bring into the room. And those qualities then become qualities which one emulates, and they may be positive or they may not be positive. And so I think, you know, every teacher has the responsibility in some ways to not only know, but also to embody that which they know. Not only to know the values, to have them memorized, but actually to live those. And so one of the design principles for the secular ethics curriculum that we are, in fact, the very first, is to provide for worthy models, that those teachers have the same ideals that we've just been speaking of. I guess on the one hand, I'm with you on the technology, and I love technology. But on the other hand, I also think that we shouldn't underestimate our teachers, especially the young people of this 21st century generation. You know, so many of them are going into Teach for America, Teach for Israel, Teach for every country in the world. And they're doing it out of pure idealism, and they often get thrown into the very worst settings, and they will just try until they drop. We often don't provide enough support for them. But I think that the problems we confront in society are never problems that are unsolvable. You know, there's always an antidote. And in some sense, I feel like there are always enough people. Yes, there may be uses for technology, and I think there will be. But I also want to affirm the remarkable capacities of our teachers. Now, they may need practice and cultivation. They may need all kinds of other methods and means. And we've tried to help bring that about through various programs. But nonetheless, I believe they're there. And the other thought, which I think is not unrelated to this, comes back to your way of characterizing meditation. I think you overstepped the line which you had set for yourself. But that there's a way in which meditation can be a form of, you use the word, investigation. That the challenge of understanding can also be a challenge to us to meditate in a way which is not only about quiescence, about poise, but actually about understanding.
That's right. Meditation, two kinds of meditation. One analytical meditation, one single-pointed meditation. So, of course, I have not much experience, but I think the whole years, you see, some transformation about my emotion, It's not single-pointed meditation, but through analytical meditation. Mm-hmm. Extremely helpful.
Extremely helpful. And a form of meditation which leads to understanding. And I'd like to just describe a little experiment which we made over several months, which was to form a group of experienced meditators and to take the question of craving, desire, and addiction as our common topic. And each session, we would teach each other a particular practice that raised the question of desire. For example, to establish quiescence, to establish peace and single-pointedness, but then to put into the center of your attention the desire which is most disturbing for you. And watch what happens to the field of attention. And then to describe that inwardly, and then to try to suppress it or let it go, or how is it that you then deal with this so that it can be released? What are the techniques? And then are there traces remaining of that disturbance? How long do they last? Are there bodily sensations? And then to share amongst ourselves that inquiry process. In other words, to not only take up the investigation individually, but to try to take it up together with a community of practiced meditators to investigate desire and its effects on consciousness directly. It was very, very interesting and I thought quite productive first attempt.
Mark, you wanted to please come in.
First.
Okay, please. Mm-hmm.
Your Holiness, thinking of human happiness and cravings, one of the points in Sarah's presentation that I appreciate most is that she's applying practices from the contemplative tradition to the pains of grasping cravings in people who have them the worst, the people who present the most difficult situations, ordinary people with these very intense cravings. And she's actually achieving some success, which seems so marvelous. Even success in the most difficult moment of sparks, triggers that are actually forest fires even when they begin, these intense cravings. And during Sarah's talk, Matthew poked me a bit when Sarah mentioned the surfing of the craving, because that's actually a successful attempt to deal with a forest fire that sparks right away. So that's so marvelous. And even if we think of these interventions merely as painkillers, it might be helpful to think that all painkillers are not alike. You know, some just stop the pain, but some reach down and reduce the inflammation or the physical throbbing pressure that's causing the pain. And if it were possible to convert these painkillers into more effective painkillers that actually reversed some of the pathology to help the healing process begin, that would be so marvelous. Maybe even possible, as Diana mentions, to convert some painkillers into a door to achieve some of the aims of flipping desire into a more positive sense that you point out is so necessary. It may be there are no
techniques.
So it seems to me the immense challenge and wonderful challenge is to develop these better techniques to more effectively do that. Fortunately, it's not mouse neuroscientists who have to do that. But even if there are no techniques to directly import already from Buddhist teachings, I wonder if it might be possible to bring to bear thinking from the Buddhist tradition as well as the empirical interventions to convert these into better painkillers beyond eating a raisin or surfing the craving, if there's ways to think about that.
That's what we are doing. Yeah.
So that's the whole point of this kind of discussion.
So the
premise of these kind of discussions is really, if you look at the resources that are available in the Buddhist tradition, many of these contemplative practices in their own traditional context have certain premises. They are grounded on certain Buddhist philosophical view of reality and so on. So what we are trying to do is to explore ways in which some of these practices can be adapted without having to take on board the underlying, more specifically Buddhist view, world view, and you know, aspects that are common, aspects that touch upon the common conditions which can be applied in a secular way.
So right from the beginning, this is some cases, you see, we use the word Buddhism and modern science dialogue. Then I felt this is wrong. We are not making some kind of dialogue between Buddhism and modern science. No. More precise, Buddhist science. Science is mentioned in the Buddhist literature. It's about mind, about a particle, about the cosmology, these things. It's mentioned in the Buddhist text, but actually that's the science. When we mention these things, there is no sort of concept of right and wrong. Simply, what is reality mentioned? So that's the science. So modern science, this is so far not much pay attention or carry research about the inner world. So there, so knowledge or explanation from Buddhist inner science can sort of that.
Can make a contribution.
Contribution. Mm-hmm. And as well as in the, because of the physical science, the modern science is much, much sort of convincing.
Advanced.
Advanced. So we Buddhists, it's a must, because of the learn that. Like that. So that is important. If we create some kind of impression that we are discussing scientists and Buddhism, no sense. So all these problems, I think from the Buddhist viewpoint, ultimately, lack of knowledge about ultimate reality. So what is ultimate reality? Absence of independent existence. That is a Buddhist concept. So no relevant here.
Your Holiness.
So in these kind of discussions, once in a while, we do touch upon the Buddhist kind of ultimate view of, the view of the ultimate nature of reality, particularly the philosophy of emptiness. But sometimes, once in a while, we do touch upon it, but that's not really a part of the the discussion.
Buddhist business.
Yes, that's Buddhist business. One time, my very dear, very close sort of Christian monk, a Catholic monk, oh, really wonderful. See, he, I think many years, adopted some Buddhist method about the promotion of compassion, forgiveness, these things. One day, you see, he asked me about this emptiness. Then I told him, this is not your business. then it became very narrow. No, we are talking about humanity.
Your Holiness, I wonder if I can steer the discussion a little bit in a different direction. One of the... I promise I'll get to you. But this is, I think, relevant. One of the One of the issues with addiction that we've been talking about is a lot of excessive self-focus. Your Holiness has very frequently commented on the benefits of analytic meditation practices. Most of the Western implementation of contemplative-based practices in therapeutic settings have not incorporated any analytic meditation mm-hmm. practices. And I wonder if there's anything that you might suggest that we consider from analytic practices that could be usefully incorporated into these kinds of programs.
Actually, you, scientists, and in your own field, you use fully about analytical meditation. Yeah. So with this glass, you see, you really look very closely and think. That's analytical meditation. So only, you see, the shift
focus.
That analytical meditation now about inner world. So that's the difference. Otherwise, analytical meditation, I think everybody, you see, caring. That's another digital word, again, because addiction is
that. So Solanus is wondering whether the English word addiction has built into it a kind of a negative connotation so that it can only be used in the context of some kind of compulsive behavior that has no control. Because he was saying that if it is simply a kind of a habituation, then one could imagine a kind of positive kind of addiction. For example, if someone has gained deep realization of emptiness, then when he or she engages with the real world, everything appears as illusion-like. There is no grasping on any solidity and or substantial reality. Similarly, someone who has...
Substantial reality is aina.
No, the inji lare.
The word, you see, English word, I think, little because that.
Intrinsic existence, independent existence. So...
Pangunya, objectively.
Something existing in its own right, objectively. So one has this kind of illusion-like...
Recently, I was in New York, talk about this emptiness.
So there was a question asked from the audience in the teaching in New York, and the question was, for someone who has been brought up in the Western intellectual tradition, what would be the first step to try to get a sense of what emptiness is about? And His Holiness' response was, study a little bit of quantum physics.
So analyze, you can't find objectively. Mm-hmm. So that's the basis of emptiness. Mm-hmm.
And then to continue, so His Holiness was saying that similarly, someone who has gained a deep realization of altruism, an altruistic awakening mind, that person is so habituated that any trigger, like a suffering being, or will really immediately evoke, without any conscious effort, the compassionate response. So would that be called addiction?
No, I think most of us would agree that addiction has a negative
connotation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's the etymology
that
comes...
No.
Okay. So in the same way, craving would have negative connotation.
So
would that be the case if you were to look at OED, Oxford English Dictionary?
I think so.
Addiction is the same root as dictator, which is often the way that I think it's experienced as being
addiction
dictated
says
by.
Dictator than deoris.
Okay, on that note.
So we promise Mark to be able to...
On that note, I think we all want to understand exactly what addiction is. And as you say, Your Holiness, we put many different perspectives together, scientific as well as from contemplative perspectives. And by looking at it from all these different angles, we really want to see what it truly is. And we may not get there for a while, but I think we're going to get there eventually. What I want to say is that I think there's a dichotomy here, or a paradox, which we haven't faced yet, which is Nora and other people talk about addiction as a disease. Is it really a disease? Or from other perspectives, for example, Sarah's perspective, it seems that there's an awful lot to do with concentration, awareness, changing the landscape of cognition, effort, practice, and these sorts of things that are not really consistent with the idea of addiction as a disease. And I think it's not just a matter of a definition or a matter of words, because if we can, when we think of addiction as a disease, one of the lines of evidence we most often point to is brain change. But we know that the brain also changes continuously with development, massively. In adolescence, it changes when you learn to play a musical instrument. The brain changes all the time. And especially, we know now that the brain changes with meditation, from Ritchie's work, for example. So brain change by itself cannot be the evidence that addiction is indeed a disease. Rather, if it is something different. And the reason why it's important is because if it's a disease, then it should be treated by doctors. And possibly we should be developing new medications. And if it's not a disease, then it should be treated by people like Sarah, with her program that highlights mindfulness and changing perspective and learning to change your perception of yourself in the world. That's why I think it's important.
So we can reflect on this over lunch and perhaps consider it some other time. So thank you for the comment, and thank you for your time, Your Holiness.
Thank you.